Journey to uncharted horizons. Budding heroes trek to every corner of Barsave, exploring what remains of their world in the wake of the life-destroying scourge. As they search for fortune and battle unspeakable monsters, these fearless adepts record their discoveries, triumphs, and defeats. The journals and letters describing their adventures form the Book of Exploration, an ever-growing record of the current state of Barsave. Assembled and maintained by the Great Library of Thrall, the Book of Exploration offers adventurers a wealth of information by posing questions, recounting legends, offering clues to ancient puzzles, describing both unimaginable depravity and selfless sacrifice, and telling the many tales that make up the tapestry of Namegiver experience. A fragment from Nutrevar. The following account comes from a surviving fragment of an adventurer's journal. The pages on which the entry below was written were the only ones left intact from what we presume to have been a large document. From the marks on the edges of the surviving pages, we must conclude that the remainder of the journal was eaten, or at any rate, chewed into pulp. The pages were recovered from the village of Nutreva in the Badlands, and based on this document, we urge travelers to give the area a wide berth. Ferlin Solis, Apprentice Scribe of the Great Library of Thrall. You who read this, leave this place. Leave now. Linger too long and you will not live to regret it. Not even I, Ortiol the Brave, can hope to defeat the terrible creatures that even now are scrabbling at the door. No barricade can keep them out for long, not even the sturdy oak door of this still room where despair has forced me to hide. My companions, Lenda the Wizard, Makto of the Rockfist Sky Raider clan, and even my most faithful friend, T'Choke of the Lowland Trolls, are all dead. I alone remain to fight this enemy as best I can before succumbing. The door shakes under their assault. It cannot be long now before they break through. I will die with the fading sunlight unless some miracle happens. We entered Nutreva this morning. The streets rang with silence. No children played. No merchants bargained to sell their wares. No old men exchanged stories of youth and courage. We called out, but no one answered. Seeking an answer to this mystery, we went to the inn, but found only more food for questions. Coals from what had clearly been a hearty fire glowed warmly in the fireplace. Plates of stew, cold and congealing, stood untouched on the tables. Forks stood alert, stuck in baked potatoes, and melted butter lay in dried pools on serving dishes. Of those who should have eaten this feast, we saw no sign. In the kitchen we found a pot of beef, the water in which it must have boiled long gone cold. Carrots and asparagus lay splayed out on a carving board, some peeled and sliced, some untouched. Lenda saw something move in a corner, but it was only a wooden doll falling from a precarious perch upon his tiny stool. The doll's eyes stared up at us, blank and lifeless. The rooms upstairs gave us no better answers than the kitchen and the common room. In the first, the bed sheets had been carelessly thrown back. A nightgown and a pair of slippers lay on the floor nearby. Upon the dressing table lay a wood comb, several long strands of silken red hair curling among its teeth. A letter, half finished, had long since soaked up the ink from a hastily discarded pen. The letter read, "My darling mother, I shall soon be home to comfort you in your time of need. I depart at sunrise tomorrow and expect to arrive." A giant ink blot obscured the rest. In the next room, an empty cradle stood in one corner, rocking gently in the breeze coming through the open window. Tiny bells hung over it to amuse the babe that had lain there. They jingled softly, their gentle music scarcely relieving the growing weight of the silence. Everywhere we saw evidence of life, but of the name-givers who had led those lives, no trace. From the window I gazed out at the deserted village. The Badlands stretched away in the distance, the racked landscape reminding us that Nutreva stood at the edge of civilization. "Where are all the people?" T'Choke grunted at last, voicing the question we had all feared to ask. "No people, no bodies even, no nothing." I kept looking out the window, unable to answer him. Then I saw something moving, far out toward the horizon. The landscape seemed to ripple like water when a stiff breeze blows across it. "What is that?" Linda breathed in my ear, gazing over my shoulder at the shuddering earth. It was coming closer even as she spoke. Behind us, Makto drew his sword. When the first wave of creatures struck Nutreva, we rallied against them and won. Makto laughed as they fled, swinging his blade above his head in a victory dance. We should have known that others would follow. So many others! They came in a great swarm, a moving red tide that swept us before it. Makto was the first to falter. I watched in dread as he fell among them. They surged over him, a great writhing throng of legs and red bodies covering him like a blanket. I rushed to aid him, but too late. As he lay gasping for air, the creatures crawled into his mouth and choked him. They crawled into his clothes, giant lumps that wriggled beneath the cloth. Their antennae tickled his face, and their clawed feet scratched his skin hard enough to draw blood. He did not flinch, or even look away. Venom from a thousand bites had paralyzed him. He could not even scream, but died without a sound. Linda fell next, shrieking in agony as they swarmed over her back and tangled themselves in her hair. She batted wildly at them, trying to knock them off, but stumbled and fell. Her screams faded into moans, then died away to nothing as the creature's poison did its work. T'Choke ran to her, crushing insect bodies beneath his heavy boots, ignoring the creatures that crawled up his body. He bent down and gathered Linda into his arms. He made it halfway to the inn's front door before they slumped to the floor together. The red tide covered them both, and I fled. I ran as fast as I could, knocking the creatures from me as I went. Pain stabbed through my forearm, followed by cold numbness. One of the monsters was clinging to my sleeve, and had bitten my sword arm. I beat at the thing. When it fell off, I kicked it into the fireplace. The creature burned quickly, exploding with a pop. I ran through the kitchen and into the still room, slammed the heavy door behind me, and locked it. I hoped the creatures would go away. With no more prey visible, they should have gone away. They should have. Then I could have unlocked the door and left the inn and this cursed village far behind me. The door is my only way out. The still room window is too small for a human to pass through. But they are massing on the other side of the door. They know I am here. They want me. I do not know how much time has passed. From the window I can see more of them coming, marching in lines like a great army moving into battle. I lost count of their numbers long ago. A sea of them carried my dead companions through the village and out across the Badlands, presumably to some hidden hive. The rest, wave upon wave of them, kept coming this way. I can hear them scrabbling up the outside wall toward the window. The door is beginning to splinter. I cannot escape death. Heed this warning. Get out. Before they come for... An Ancient Mystery. This account is taken from the journal of Corbin Shadowfire, Wind Scout of the Fourth Circle. He gave it into our hands, along with a tattered map and the words, "Do what you like with this. Publish it. Burn it. I don't care." May you have better luck with it than we did. Naled Enbar, Apprentice Archivist of the Great Library of Thrall.
A good inn with competent guards is a wonderful thing, especially after the week we've just lived through. In all these months of adventuring, we've never come back to civilization so sorely hurt and exhausted as this. Norval is healing quickly. Thanks be to Garlen. I must remember to compose a proper tribute to the healing passion. All of us are tired to death, wounded in both body and soul. We managed to repair our pattern after poor Cav's death, but the effects of the damage remain. Still, there are others who fare worse than we do. Fate chose to remind us of this just last night. As we were rehashing the whole cursed journey over our dinner, a human at the next table turned around and said, with a sympathetic smile,
"Run a bad luck?" "Bad luck," retorted Gatooth,
ready to start up out of his seat and fling himself on the offending inquirer. Senna put a hand on his shoulder, and he sat back down, but with obvious effort. "Such touchy folks, orcs."
"You're lucky you only lost one," said the man. "I went adventuring in the same place you did, and I lost everything."
"Well, after a beginning like that, who wouldn't want to hear the tale? We made room for one more at our table, and the human, Dzar Illidetz, lone survivor of the adventuring band known as the Falcon's Talons,
told us the story I have here set down. We'd gone to the Mist Swamps looking for a rare plant that our employer, a wealthy barter-town merchant, swore would fetch a prettier penny than we'd ever seen before. I know it's been said that there's some strange things in the Mist Swamps, but we've been around the town a few times. Not much we didn't know about adventuring, or so we thought. The risk seemed worth the pay, so we went. When we reached the place where fire burns atop the water, we knew we'd found the place where the plant was said to grow. All we had to do was find some, cut a few, and pack them careful. Easy money. We camped, tried to eat a little dinner in spite of the smell of the swamp, and went to bed. Gickle, our nethermancer, seemed uneasy. Kept starting up and staring across the dark swamp waters, but she couldn't say exactly what was troubling her. Tiskran can get awfully flighty sometimes, so we put her fits down to that and thought nothing more of it. When morning came and nothing strange had happened, that only seemed to prove everything was fine. Slow and careful, we wandered down the edges of the swamp, looking for clumps of the plant we sought. Suddenly, our scout Ariel let out a whoop and pointed across the swamp to a clump of scrubby trees. Through the leaves and thin trunks, we could just see the ruins of some stone building. A small one, not a palace or anything like that. It looked like it had exploded from the inside out. We got as close as we could to the ruin without actually setting foot in the swamp, but we couldn't get near enough to see much. As we drew closer, the air seemed to tingle, you know, the way it feels just before lightning strikes. Hairs on your arms rise and that kind of thing. It was magic, so strong we could almost smell it. Couldn't be sure what kind, though. So Gickle and Shosala, Shosi's our elementalist, start arguing about what to do next. Both of them are wild to find out what the magic is. Some treasure or weapon, they're hoping. But Shosi's afraid of the magic might be tainted somehow. A cautious one, she always was. Gickle's all for throwing caution to the four winds. She's a nethermancer, by the passions, she says. And she'd have smelled taint if it was there. Finally, she's had enough of Shosi's warnings, and she steps into the swamp. See? She calls out, striding toward the ruins. There's nothing to be afraid. And then all of a sudden, Gickle clutches at her head, gives a wild scream, and drops like a felled tree. Without thinking, I ran to pull her out before she could drown. I happened to look toward the ruins as I stood up with Gickle in tow, and I saw on part of the wall, still standing, was a Theron Imperial seal. Whatever the stone building had been, the Therons had used it as some kind of outpost. Well, that bit of news made Shosala wild to get inside the place. Whatever dangers the ruined building offered, she was sure that the Therons must have left behind some powerful magical item. Anything that could make itself felt so strongly after several hundred years and remain free from horror taint must be powerful enough to be worth just about any risk. Or so she said. So, after waving her hands around and muttering a bit to keep herself safe from harm, Shosala waded into the swamp. She got farther than Gickle, I'll give her that. About 10 paces from the ruins, she wavered and disappeared like a reflection when you drop a pebble in it. We just stared, too shocked to even cry out. We were sure Shosala was dead, disembodied by ancient Theron magic or whatever it was. You could have knocked us all over with a breath of wind when she turned up the next morning, her clothes covered in green stains and bug spots, swearing about thrice-damned Theron magicians and their half-baked ideas. After she got a cup of hot tea in her, and had calmed down a bit, she told us that she'd somehow jumped, or shifted. She had trouble finding the right word. From the middle of the swamp to an entirely different part of it, between one step and another. She said she'd felt a pulling sensation, like a giant hand plucking at her clothes and hair. Then she'd heard a terrible ripping sound, felt horribly sick for just a moment, and found herself in an unfamiliar part of the bogs. Nowhere near the burning waters she knew we'd camped by. When she got over feeling sick and dizzy, she'd plotted out the direction where she thought our camp lay as best she could, and struck out toward it. She hadn't even stopped for nightfall, just slowed down a bit so as not to wander into a quicksand patch. It had taken her close to a day to get back. Well, nothing would do after that but for Morgwin, our warrior, to give it a go. He strode out into the swamp, the black waters coming up higher than his waist, puffs of swamp fire almost singeing his beard. 10 paces from the ruins, he vanished. I told him so, muttered Shosala, and stomped off to find a little washing water. Morgwin turned up as the sun was setting, looking peevish. It seemed the Theron's magic was working to keep interlopers like us away from whatever they'd left in the ruins. I pointed out that we'd come for something else entirely, that our employer was waiting for us with cold, hard coin in Bartertown, and that poor Gickle needed help that we weren't going to find out in the mist swamps. After a little grumbling, the others gave up on Theron Ruin and hunted for the plants we'd come for instead. We found a nice little stand of the stuff a day and a half later, and I thought we were fair on our way to spending the merchant's payment. Little did I know, huh? The trouble started as soon as we left the area. One of our horses stepped into quicksand. Morgwin tried to free the beast and fell into a neighboring pool. Before we could pull him out, some horrible creature with tentacles like thick ropes pulled him under. Gickle went next, died of a fever that burned her to nothing from the inside out in less than 3 days. Then a thief tried to rob us at a roadside inn and stabbed poor Shosi in the gut. The wound wouldn't drain right, and infection set in. I couldn't stay, so I left her to the care of a traveling healer who'd shared a meal with us. And to top it all off, I lost the pack with the plants in it, fording a stream that shouldn't have been in spate for another 3 months. The strap gave way, even though I'd taken care to repair all of our leather gear before setting out. That strap shouldn't have broken, but it did. So here I am, stuck in Bartertown with no pay and no prospect of work. No companions either. I don't suppose you'd consider buying my journal for a few silvers, would you? We bought the journal, though Gatuth swore that Dazar had made up his tale. At first, it seemed Gatuth was right. The journal was poorly written, full of misspellings, and contained no accounts of interest. However, on the last page of it, we found a map to the place of Burning Waters in the Mist Swamps, with the location of the Theron Ruin precisely marked. If there is a powerful magical item hidden within those ancient stones, surely there must be some way to defeat the strange displacement spell and reach the ruins themselves. Who better than myself and my companions to attempt such a heroic feat?
Citadel in the Sky.
The following document was an anonymous bequest to the Great Library. As is often the case with such offerings, we assume the donor acquired this document through less than savory means. Though we sometimes refuse such gifts, our work at the library is too important to be overly scrupulous, for the accumulation and dissemination of knowledge is the primary means by which we will restore our world to its true glory. This account appears to be an excerpt of a log kept by one Quinn Zeraph, while he served as sergeant-at-arms of the airship Storm's Delight, a Theron air mining vessel. Relford of Lutain, scribe of the Great Library of Thrall.
62-4-1046. Today began like all others. We woke at dawn to a meager breakfast, then took to the sky. As always, the rush of the early morning gave way to dull routine. Hours passed as the sharp-eyed watchers scanned the sky for telltale shimmer of true air, and the rest of the crew took turns watching over the slaves or readying the fire cannons. The last few months had seemed to stretch forever. We had found an occasional haul, but most of the time we had simply shuffled about the ship's deck performing various chores to relieve the tedium. Today, however, would end differently. Jarka, the newest of our watchers, was the first to spot the faint shimmer dancing above the clouds. Captain Vallis bellowed his familiar orders, and the ship's bow swung toward our quarry. With the sound of whip cracks rising from the hold, the ship lurched forward, and a fresh breeze washed across the deck. Our slaves had good strong backs, and Storm's Delight was a fast vedette, but the shimmering continued to dance ahead of us. Slowly we realized that it was no small pocket of air that we chased, for as we edged closer, the shimmering grew until it filled the entire sky. Vallis smiled, knocking the ashes from his pipe.
"Men, even 100 of this catch would fill our hold," he said, his eyes sparkling with greed. "Extend the nets, ready the cannons, and let's hope our mates will be happy to see us return so soon."
The captain's enthusiasm infected the entire crew, and within moments the deckhands had the long poles set and the orichalcum nets stretched out like wings. The net boys waded along the storm's railing with their orichalcum-laced pots in hand, ready to scramble across the net's wiry surfaces and collect the falling shards of true air.
The gunners cried out from the front of the ship as they finished their preparations. At the captain's word, a single cannon belched, and a ball of flame crashed into the shimmering sky. As hundreds of glass-like shards of true air rained down on the ship and nets, a stale breath seemed to wrap around the ship. Every crewman froze, as if shackled to the deck. Even the net boys forgot to collect the rapidly evaporating treasure. The charge had not just knocked true air free, it had pierced a hole in the shimmering sky itself, revealing a glistening city, an entire care floating within the pocket of true air. It was minutes before anyone moved. As usual, Phallus's voice broke the silence.
"Well then, Quinn," he said, turning to me. "Gather some men and check her out."
I chose 20 sailors and we piled into the storm's launch. Within a few minutes, we reached the breach. Only the bow of our craft fit through, but it was enough. One by one, my men scrambled onto the bow of the launch, then jumped the short gap to the Care's deck. I followed, carrying a docking rope. The air smelt like dust and tickled the back of my throat, though I could not see a spot of dirt. The Care was made from field stones, but they were covered with some kind of glossy coating, like the shiny crust on a well-baked loaf of bread. I counted 16 decks from where I stood, with undoubtedly more hidden below. Overhead, I counted a dozen towers connected by a web-like maze of bridges. I tied the launch to the deck's railing and gestured toward a large archway. Without a word, my men fell into step behind me, crossbows in hand. The portal opened to a great hall with vaulted ceilings hundreds of feet overhead and walls covered with delicate marble carvings. For a moment, I stood transfixed by the beauty and grandeur of the sight. Then my gaze fell upon the floor, which was covered by a carpet of gray, twisted bodies. No scent of rotting flesh, no trace of decay was present, just the sharply contorted corpses, their faces still bent around their dying screams. My body stiffened like a spring wound too tight. Horrors had been here, may still be here, I thought. I took a step back and opened my mouth to order a withdrawal, when a smoke-like shadow burst through the floor. Creaking laughter rolled through the room as the horror, I knew it was a horror, attacked my men, their bodies withering from a mere brush of its scythe-like arms. It swept between us and the exit, forcing us farther into the room. I ordered my men to spread out, hoping we could slip around the creature. But as we picked our way through the bodies, the floor itself began to writhe. The corpses unwound their tangled limbs, staggered to their feet, and began to raise their voices in a crescendo of inhuman ululation. I do not remember giving the order, but within seconds my men had drawn their swords and we hacked our way through the clawing jungle of corpses. At the railing we turned to fight, as one by one we leapt back through the breach. As we battled our way free, the gray shadow lurked above us. Its unceasing laughter made my flesh crawl. But I pushed away my fear and focused on my attacks. Blow followed blow as my world shrank down to a sea of dead flesh and the silvery flash of my blade. Then a rough pair of hands grabbed my shoulder and shoved me toward the launch. Jumping the chasm, I crawled through the opening and into the craft. Then I turned to see Thassil, my second, land on the edge of the small rocking craft. He reached his hands toward me, the very hands that had pushed me to safety. But as I reached out to help him, and the air shook with the ringing of a giant bell, and the bow of the launch splintered as the breach crashed shut. Thassil's severed hands fell to the deck beside my feet. Only 8 of us returned to Storm's Delight. I begged Captain Phallus to open another breach and let me save the men we had left behind. But he simply shook his head and ordered the navigators to plot a course for camp. I could read his thoughts in his eyes. He had lost too many men already, and though I hate to admit it, a part of me rejoiced at his refusal. The Growing Bones.
The following account comes from a journal that records the adventures of a group of known as the Five Weedles. Regretfully, the journal's author, the dwarf archer Hansig TrueEye, did not provide even the names of the Scorchers mentioned in this entry, an omission that has severely hampered the few explorers who have attempted to retrace the Five Wheels' path. Unfortunately, Hansig may never have a chance to expand on his account, as no one has heard from the Five Wheels since they ventured into the Badlands several months ago. Tom Edrule, archivist and scribe of the Hall of Records. Day 13. For nearly 2 weeks, we have traveled from Kratos. Tylon's in sight. No sign of slavers. Feels like 2 months. We're running low on food, and Riggo died in a crackbill attack, of all things. So now, we're short an elementalist as well. No matter. I can see the slavers in my dreams. And the archer that can see does not miss. Traskin sees only the gold. You can't eat gold. You can eat crackbills, though, Gamage assured me. He said they taste like Hurlg. Rancid Hurlg, I say. Day 15, morning. Under the Tylons, have encountered a Scorcher tribe. They claim all this land from the left peak of the Tylons on down to the Faded River. Gamage is handling them now. Scorchers appreciate having a famous cavalrywoman giving them a 1-2, I'm sure. At least we brought an adept the Scorchers will accept without laughing. Nothing else is working right. Day 16. Gamage has earned us passage through the tribe's land. Apparently the orcs consider roasted crackbill a delicacy. Traskin has detected fresh signs of the slavers at last. Fewer tracks this time. Apparently they lost a few men. Maybe they had trouble with the Scorchers. Sometimes Scorchers are a slaver hunter's best friend. Gamage looks concerned. Traskin points up toward a low ridge. We are deep in the Tylons now, but still in Scorcher territory. Traskin says the tracks lead there. Gamage shakes her head. The Scorchers said we could not go up there on the ridge. Why? I ask. No matter. Gamage didn't ask why. Orcs. Dip them in batter and leave them for the dragons, I say. Traskin asks if Gamage would rather have the friendship of Scorchers or the blood of slavers on her spear. That turns the shaft. We go up now, up the ridge. Traskin makes a face. He does not like what he senses at the top of the climb. Day 18. On top of the ridge. It commands a view of a valley that turns into a pass and runs through the side of the mountain. The entire valley is dead. A vast stretch of dry, brown, and gray earth. No living plants in sight. Weird place. Ahead of us looms a dark form. Gamage is chanting her horror fend. Day 21. At closer range, the dark form appears to be some sort of building. A castle, perhaps. It is made of bone. Gleaming bones and metal. Jewelry and bodies, stone and plants and more bleached bones. Shields of shattered foes hang from it like banners. Long lances stick out like arms. Skulls festooned with gems are haphazardly set in it like keystones. A dark buzzing cloud of carrion birds and bugs hang over the entire structure. The building is vast. It stretches across almost the entire blasted valley. There is very little smell, however. Most odd. A low, rough-looking fence of spears and ribcages surround the place. None of us has dared cross it yet. Traskin senses no horrors in the area. I see no signs of undead creatures. We are still uneasy, however. The sky remains dark as night, even at high noon. Gamage is shuddering along with her horse. Day 22. Today we crossed the terrible fence. We found no opening in the bone building itself, but as we ventured to its far side, we encountered a most fantastic sight. At the other end of the valley stood another, almost identical castle of the dead. Even more puzzling, we spied two obsidian, each sitting in front of one of the castles. Both rock men sit, unmoving, on some sort of colored rug or mat. a single wooden bowl resting next to each one. The obsidians stare at one another across two vast mazes of bones. Neither of them acknowledges our presence. Traskin assures me that they are alive. Traskin has the scout's sight. I have the archer's, and what I can see here disturbs me. I look at one obsidian close up. His eyes never move, never blink. Do obsidian blink? No matter. He has no pupils, just eyes of pale yellow, yet I know what he is staring at. I look at his rival across the way. Later, I realize that we have spent 6 days investigating the terrible Valley of Death and its mysterious inhabitants. 6 days that undoubtedly the slavers have spent riding away from us. Casting nervous glances at the awesome towers of bone, we return to the slaver's trail, which leads us past the second tower, down the valley, and into the countryside beyond. No matter. I can see the slavers now, on the horizon. The archer who can see never misses. Day 27. Finally, we are heading homeward. Two of the slavers escaped us initially, the scout and the train driver. Traskin tracked them doubling back, heading back into the Tylons. He had their scent, and he could not lose them. Their trail has led us back into the Dark Valley. The Rockmen are still here. Traskin guesses they haven't moved in years. The terrible towers have grown since we were gone. Gamaj, with his horse sense, realizes it first. From the top of the northern tower, the banner of the slave driver hangs in the still air, mounted on a crude flag mast fashioned from the scout's arm, which still bears his distinctive armor. The slave driver's head sits atop the flag mast, surveying the valley with unseeing eyes. No matter. The bounty pays for the slave driver himself, or evidence of his death. We shall borrow the gruesome trophy and use it to gain our gold. Archers can always see how best to reach a goal. I can see the slave driver's face in my sights now.